Okay. I just want to take a moment to welcome everyone. This is Neil Satin of NaturalDogBlog.com. And tonight I'm going to be interviewing Kevin Behan of NaturalDogTraining.com. He is the creator of Natural Dog Training. We're going to be hearing a lot from him about what he's doing currently, what he's done in the past, and maybe where things are going. For him, I just wanted to give you a quick background for those of you listening about how I came to know Kevin and what my own story is. I'm going to keep it quick. Many of you have read on my blog or elsewhere that I had a dog who is named Nola. I still have her. She's 13 years old. She was very aggressive toward other dogs. And I had struggled over the years to figure out some way to help her and tried conventional methods of dog training that really didn't do anything. And if anything, they seemed to be aggravating the problem. And then through a series of coincidences, really, I came across Kevin's website back when there wasn't much on it. And now there's actually quite a bit of material on his website about natural dog training. And it really intrigued me, and Kevin and I ended up talking over the phone, and I decided just through talking with him over the phone that I would go and work with him in Vermont. And that was, I think our first conversation, Kevin, was actually about 7 years ago. I did the math earlier.
Right.
So
right.
It's been
a
while. So I worked with Kevin, saw immediate results with Nola, and in the course of a weekend that we spent together, decided that I would basically try to convince him that he should take me on as an apprentice. And so I could actually spend some time with him and learn not only about how dogs work, but one thing that struck me in our initial time together was that Kevin's approach to working with dogs really ripples out into almost a metaphysics for how life works and how people work and how the world has evolved. And, you know, I've learned in my life that when you meet people like that, it's worth spending time with them to figure out, you know, what they're talking about. So anyhow, that's how I came to work with Kevin. We spent a long month together in the summer of 2004, and the rest is history, and I've really appreciated his help along the way with really transforming my approach to dogs and relationships, and it, you know, definitely it was a pivotal moment for me working with Kevin. So it's really exciting for me to be able to interview him here and maybe introduce him to all of you. I have hopes that we'll do a conference call as well. So some of you will actually be able to get on the line with Kevin and ask him some questions. But I think you'll find that his viewpoint is one that really opens your perspective about how your dog works and how the world works. And I hope that this is really valuable for you. So having said all that, I'm going to give Kevin, welcome, a moment to just give us a quick introduction to who he is, and you know, over the course of tonight's interview, you're going to learn a lot more about Kevin. So, Kev, you don't have to cover it all.
Okay. Yeah,
right now.
Excellent.
But go ahead, if you wouldn't mind, just giving the people listening a quick synopsis of who you are, what you do, and you know where you come from.
Great. Well, thanks, Neil. Actually, the best part of my theory is that I get to meet people of like mind on a quest to learn everything that we can learn from interacting with animals such as yourself. So that's what's really the best part about this journey is being able to talk to people that are of like mind. So, you know, that's what's most fun about working with dogs on this level. So basically my story is I grew up in the dog training business. My father was one of the first. He was really a pioneer of his time and took the science on dogs. He was a dog trainer. He got his start during World War II in the war dog program. He trained dogs at Fort Royal in Virginia for deployment overseas, mostly the Pacific Theater. And he was a very gifted trainer. And after the war, he found that he could make a living doing this. It was kind of the beginning of the family dog market. He started out with sport training for field dogs and protection training, security work and police work, but the family dog market grew up and became the bulk of what we did. So my background was working with the protection and police dogs, a little bit the bird dogs, but that kind of went by the boards as our area got more and more developed, suburban.
Now, he was pretty, like, old-school dominance-style trainer,
yeah,
right?
But in his time, he was a very sophisticated update of it so that he was the first one to really apply the idea of a dominant hierarchy, that canines and human beings were organized the same way, and that there was a leader and discipline and respect, and you should appeal to an individual's pride to perform well for the group, and this is what built social cooperation. And it was a very sophisticated philosophy for its time, and was to be superseded by the monks of New Skete, and then maybe Barbara Woodhouse came along, and now Caesar Milan would be the heir in that, you know, in the logical line of progression and that way of thinking. Each one being a little bit different, a little more modern, I suppose. But so he was quite possibly the first one to mimic the wolf, the so-called wolf pack organization, or the pack theory, as I call it, and say that the problem, most problem behavior, was a lack of respect for the owner as a leader. That every dog started out worshiping its owner, and then the owner proceeds to throw it away by reading human stuff into it and not understanding how the canine mind works. So anyhow, I grew up in that business, and it made sense to me, and he was the most successful trainer of his time, and so I went to college, as people do, and then I ended up in the business, the family business, and I started getting really fascinated by things that dogs did, because they weren't, the data wasn't matching the theory. And I started having more and more questions. I turned to science and other training methods. I got the most out of working with the German-European way of looking at drive and studying everything about body language and paying such close detail to every little detail of what dogs do, and tying it into the natural way that animals work in the wild and when they hunt, the wolves when they hunt. So I came up with a new... I had a lot of breakthroughs, and then I came up with a new theory, and basically for the last, I think in 1978, I came up with my breakthrough concept, and since then I've been applying myself to understanding that and all the various things that dogs, not only dogs, but what animals do as well. So you can boil it all down simply with the word energy and emotion as energy. As the basis of a group mind, a group consciousness, a collective intelligence. So that's basically what I've been studying the last 30 years and how that works. I guess what's interesting about what I'm doing, particularly interesting, is that it applies to the regular, practical, everyday life. It's not some, I mean, I get very theoretical and abstract. I always got to try to find a way to communicate more simply, but it ultimately just boils down to the nuts and bolts of living with a dog and understanding everyday reality, and that there's something really magical going on inside a dog, in between a dog and a human, and I'm believing it's completely going by the boards with the mainstream science and the way of looking at things that is out in the marketplace at the moment, and that we are going to change, right, Neil?
Absolutely.
Good.
Absolutely. Do you remember what crystallized it for you back then, you know, 30-some-odd years ago?
Yeah, I was going to work one morning as usual. It was early in the morning, and a day or we were I was training a dog with my father in protection, and he was making the point the day or so before. It really struck me, and he said that a dog doesn't fight to protect its owner. He fights or bites to protect himself. He has no idea. I mean, he can get away. So why can't the owner get away? And it wouldn't make any sense to the dog to stay and fight over a household or over a possession and even the owner, because the natural impulse of the dog is to get away. Any animal will avoid a fight if possible because there's no vets out in the wild, and you could win a fight, but if you're injured, you're still dead. So animals have this urge to avoid conflict as much as they can, and that's why you need to train a dog to stay and fight. And the main thing I pulled out of that was that the dog couldn't entertain the owner's point of view. And so I was focusing on that, and then I was also focusing on my own situation when I can't entertain any other point of view but my own. And in conjunction with all that, I was thinking about the notion that dogs have no sense of time. I go down to get the mail and come back to the house, and Rommel, our dog, is ecstatic to see me, just as if I went away for 2 weeks of camping and came home. And you see that with our clients all the time. They go to Europe for months to come back. The dog's ecstatic to see him, but they drop him off for toenail clipping, and they come back in 20 minutes, and the dog's just as ecstatic to see him. So it was obvious that a dog had no sense of time and no ability to entertain any other point of view but its own, immediate moment point of view. And so all these two ideas converged in my mind with the understanding that when I was really emotional, I had no concept of time. You know, I'm going to get in trouble if I do this. Or any other point of view but that immediate moment one. Any other point of view but my father will get mad at me. I could care less. I couldn't entertain it. So I made the linkage that emotion is an immediate moment point of view and has no concept of time in it. And that's what dogs are. They're immediate moment, wholly in the present, emotional animals. And that also means that emotion works as a function of attraction. They're attracted to everything. They have no idea how things work. They're attracted, which therefore followed that the way things work, the way they relate to others, as if they do have a comprehension of other people's points of view or other dogs' points of view, and the consequences of things over time, causes and effects. That's actually built into the nature of emotion itself, that emotion is energy and it has properties and principles of movement, so that if you're watching two dogs interact, you're actually watching one group mind refracting into these various properties so that you can actually decode it. You can actually see the process by which the dog's mind works if you stop reading thoughts into it. If you don't read any idea of time into it, or that the dog sees itself as relative to another self. And if you can make that leap, you then, I believe, are granted access to what's going on inside the dog's mind, because components of the dog's mind are playing out for you in real time right in front of you. So one dog is manifesting one property of emotion, the other dog is manifesting the other property of emotion. And the reason that they're acting intelligent is that this intelligence is built into the nature of emotion itself, that the information's in the energy, and how it works through a dog's temperament is what not only animates it but informs it. So basically, it was my electron microscope. I could see into the dog's mind. I could see beneath instinct, what others called instinct and associations and fixed action patterns and all the scientific terminology. I realized we're not elemental. You could actually see beneath that. There was something going on that was much more elemental and fundamental than that stuff. So that's basically my idea in a nutshell, that emotion is energy, it has principles of movement and innate properties, and that animals tune into this, and they align around this. And everything they do is a function of attraction according to these properties and principles. That's the theory.
Now, I'm going to ask you this question just for the, I guess, the Freudians out there. Mm-hmm. What did he think of your theories?
Well, I'm not a particularly open person by design or temperament, you know, so I keep things pretty quiet, and I just study and watch. I've always been an observer. And one thing you learn in the dog business is it's very dogmatic. And when you start to go off the track, you know, you will get a strong response. So at first I thought I was just learning a better way to prove that my father was right. But after a couple of years, especially after I started working with German dog trainers and their way of looking they didn't believe in the dominant theory per se when it came to training. They did believe in it in terms of relationship, but they thought it, if you overdid it, you ruined the dog, and that was obviously true. But sooner or later, I started to get the logical conclusion was that dog behavior, social behavior, is self-organizing. There's not a leader directing, and cooperation doesn't depend on authority. So I started encouraging puppy owners to play with their dogs and let them bite, never correct them when they're young, and protect them from situations where they would normally get into trouble, try to forestall that as long as I could. So customers would call up, and they'd love what I was saying, and they'd be doing it, and things would be going great. But then they'd call up and get my father, and he'd hear what they were doing and start contradicting me. So it started to get a little dicey. But then my father was kind of semi-retired, and so I had the run of the place. I could do things as long as it was successful and you know, numbers were going up. I thought I would prove it business-wise, but that was happening. But sooner or later, the philosophies clashed like tectonic plates, and that was the end of that experiment, and I had to go off on my own.
Mm.
That's what happened.
Cast out into the wilderness.
Yep. But I can look back in retrospect and appreciate that there was no other way it could have worked out. You know, you just have to go. You have to launch into it. There's no way you can marry and compromise. You just can't mix oil with water and blend it. So that's been my journey.
It's interesting because, as you know, you and I were talking about earlier, as you bring a new perspective to old questions, or maybe reframe the questions so that they're being asked a little bit differently, it can even bring out a negative response in the most positive of positive reinforcement-based trainers.
Right, right. Yeah, it's I was following a thread that you were engaged with on one of the forums, that it was interesting. One of the commenters made a very astute observation, a really good point, when they said to you, they said to somebody who's being very abrasive to your comments, said, "Geez, how come we don't treat Neil like we say we're supposed to treat other dogs and approach him with? We want him, you know, we want to persuade him, I'm assuming, and so why don't we?" We want him to think like we do or do what we want him to do. Yeah, and I don't mean to put that in a pejorative way, but, you know, we want to engage him like we would want to engage a dog. But how come we're not treating him like that? And we call ourselves positive. So what happened for me in my theory was, well, if dogs don't understand other points of view or causes and effects over time, well, how then was I going to account for those incidents where, I mean, it seems self-evident they understand your point of view, the owner's point of view, another dog's point of view, and they understand the consequences of things over time. How was I going to account for complexity and learning and, you know, all the things, the dog opening a doorknob, was he not intending to let himself outside, and all that kind of stuff? And that led me to understand the other side of emotion as pure flowing energy is unresolved emotion or stress as pent-up energy. So I ultimately came to realize that when you're talking to someone about animals, you're really talking to them about how unresolved emotion makes one feel, which is why it gets so charged, so heated, so quickly, and why it is really stressful to question first principles when it comes to the nature of animals. So we're getting, yeah, there's an inverse, there's a direct and inverse relationship between emotion and stress. That was the next big breakthrough concept, was when I understood that there's an inverse relationship between emotion and stress, that they're equal opposites of the same thing, sort of like ice is to water, water being a current of energy and ice being a stored up form of energy that could become a current. It's latent. It could become energy later. So when I understood that animals are carrying around a charge, an emotional charge that's built up from unresolved emotion, it accretes all the entire lifetime. It never goes away. It's in the organism, the body's cells itself. And the other thing that's interesting about it is the individual doesn't have autonomous access to it and certainly doesn't have control over it. It requires an external trigger to activate. So every animal, the human animal included, is driven by this unresolved energy that we're like batteries. We walk around, we acquire it, and then we store it, and we want to discharge it to feel whole again. But we don't have control over that. The animals don't have control over that. They need an external trigger. And this makes, so they project this into others, and it looks as if they're aware of the other one's point of view, but it's really their own reflection, if you will. And anyhow, to go back to your point about not expecting a positive response, even from positive dog trainers, the reason is I believe that when we talk about dogs, we're really talking about the deepest layer of our own emotional battery that's filled with this so-called unresolved emotion. And it really stirs our tank, and it's very – and no one knows that better than me. I mean, I now know that what my father and I were arguing about in those years wasn't about dogs. It was about how dogs made us feel, how it triggered our unresolved emotion. And so I like one of my expressions is a charge as old as Ireland was coming up between us, so it wasn't going to end well. Actually, it did end kind of well, considering, but in the short term, it wasn't going to end well. But at any rate, that's what's going on in the debate about animals. It's actually not about the evidence per se. It's about how animals give us a charge. So if we could see through that charge, we could then see, I believe, accurately what's going on.
So now might be a good time to take a few of the points that you've made and like actually make it concrete. So, you know, something like there's an inverse relationship between stress and energy. Can you encapsulate that in a story about a dog that will make that real for?
Yeah. Okay. That's I think the most vivid, I started working with a dog in the early 80s, and I was doing everything positive from the protection dog way of looking at things. So I was making my body language soft and fluid and prey-like and drawing the dog out, trying to be totally non-confrontational. And this was a really good dog imported from Germany. He was full of fire. He was just a perfect police dog. He had no reservation about biting a human, but he loved people, so it was going to be easy to shape him into police work. But I was in my super positive phase. So I was going to use no stress whatsoever. And the fascinating thing was that the more positive I was, the dog started going into avoidance behavior. And he was like getting more and more conflicted. He had no energy. He's looking away. He didn't want to engage me. And I was very, very confused until I finally realized, wow, there must be a battery. This dog is holding back energy. And if I don't trigger it, I'm just piling more energy into the system, and it's as if I'm doing negative stuff to him. So by being positive and adding energy to the system, I wasn't attracting the negative, and therefore the dog didn't feel free to release it. It's sort of like, I like to give the example where, you know, you're home and you look at a bill or something and say, oh, man, this guy overcharged me, or there's something wrong with this statement. And you go to the store to confront the merchant or whatever, and they're so nice to you, and you find yourself immobilized. And, you know, business has figured that out, to be as polite as they can, because they don't attract your stress that way. Whereas if they're – and so, you know, you find yourself, it's really hard if you're a nice person to generate that level of indignation that might get you over the hump and get what you need out of them. And it's so easy, though, when they get defensive. No, you can let them have it. So it's much easier if they're not being straight with you and not being positive with you. You can really let them – you can really express yourself much more easily. So we find that we have to, like, get angry before we can really express ourselves. And that kind of speaks to this battery, that it takes a negative to trigger it. And then I started
– in that analogy, it almost sounds like you're saying the customer with the charge on his bill, that's like the dog. And yeah. In order for that customer to be able to express what they need to express, they need to get some trigger,
right.
some way of expressing it from
right.
the business person.
Yeah, something confronting them, something resisting them.
Mm-hmm.
And then that triggers this battery, and out it comes, and that starts to feel good. And that's what the dog recognizes as success. Even if something really bad happens, if it got this energy that was pent up out of its system in the short term, that's all the dog can learn. I like to use the expression that we all hate to throw up, but we sure do feel better after we do. As the older we get, the quicker we want to do it and get it over with, because we sure do feel better as soon as we get that toxin out of our system. So the dog, that's exactly how the dog learns on that dysfunctional loop, is if he just vomits all that energy in one big explosion, he does feel better. No matter how, like, a dog will start a fight and get beaten up every time, but for that split second, he did feel better. And that's all he can really learn, which is why you'll find that the dog that loses the fight always starts them. Because he ends up with more charge, and he gets more addicted to releasing that charge, seeking relief from that charge. So I became aware of this idea of the battery, and that it needs this negative that you and I now call a predator aspect. A predator has to trigger it. So when I was being super duper positive, prayful to this dog that I was talking about, I was training, I wasn't triggering his battery because I wasn't acting predator, i.e. confrontational. I was, you know, going away because my father and I were doing, you know, really intense predator, confrontational, defensive training, as a sport guy would call it. But we were putting out this predator energy, and so dogs were really intensely reacting to us, but we were also kind of overdoing it and scaring them too much. And so then that's what made me not like that approach totally. I could see there were some glitches in the way the dog was responding. So I, of course, overcompensated, went to the super-duper positive approach, which turned out to be even worse because I was driving the dog into avoidance even more, and that gave me a new way of looking at the so-called positive training movement. So at any rate, but I started to understand this idea of a battery, and it was actually served many purposes in consciousness. It was an emergency energy reserve boost. But it was also guiding, a tuning mechanism. And then there was another dog I worked with that was a little Bichon Frise that could not be groomed. It became unbelievably violent and had to be sedated, right down to operation stage, preoperative sedation. And the vet said, you know, sooner or later this dog's going to die just because we got to cut his toenails. So they sent the people to me. And I have a little method of vetting dogs and grooming dogs so that without sedation or muzzles, they can learn to be calm about it. And I worked through it with the owner, and that was great. We're plucking his ears and cutting his nails. Then she says to me, oh, that's great, I can do it, but, you know, I'm not a groomer. Can my groomer come to the next lesson and you teach her how to do it so she can do all that fancy scissoring and trimming and so on and so forth? So I said, sure. So the next week, the groomer comes. We put the dog on the grooming table as before. And I expected a little regression, but I was completely unprepared for what happened. The groomer lays out all her tools. She's got the sprays and the electric scissors, the clippers, and the leather scabbards and everything. The scissors in their leather, oily scabbards, so unique sights, smells, and sounds. And we go to do the training, and the dog was just about ready to erupt into a vicious, aggressive display when it suddenly keeled over and passed out in a state of catatonic paralysis with the fangs were bared, the claws were clenched, and it was passed out just as if it had been sedated. And it was amazing that this memory, this old memory, because the groomer came with those triggers, those very specific triggers, they were deeper triggers than I was triggering when I was cutting his nails and doing this, because she came with all these unique triggers. It took the dog to a deeper place in his battery, the place where he had been sedated. So anyhow, that really opened my mind up to that everything that ever happens to a dog, even stuff when he's sedated, is being registered on a energetic cellular level, and the dog relives it when those triggers come back. I mean, it's really an amazing thing that the dog actually relived being sedated, complete with all the reflexes of the fangs and the claws. It was the most amazing thing. I thought for a few horrible seconds, I thought the dog had just died. And, you know, I had, there was one tragic incident when my father's kennel burned down, and I had helped pull out the bodies, and they all had that same characteristic clenched teeth and everything. They were really right at the end fighting the most horrible predator in their eyes, the flame and the smoke coming at them. When I saw that same body state in this dog, I really thought he had just, like, had a heart attack and died or something.
Oh, wow.
But within about, 10 seconds, he snapped out of it, and then he was fine. And it was a happy ever after. He went home, and the woman groomed him for the rest of his life, and that was that. But
he started breathing again.
He did, yeah. So,
no, I mean you.
Right, we all started breathing again. But that was the most amazing display of I call that physical memory. So what I'm saying that's different is, the idea of unresolved emotion isn't different. The idea of cellular physical memory isn't different. But what I'm saying that's different is that unresolved emotion as a basis of physical memory of all experience is also the basis of a networked intelligence. That this unresolved emotion in each individual's battery becomes a tuning device that allows animals to communicate with each other on the animalistic energetic plane. Even the human animal can participate. And it's in terms of this unresolved energy that we all carry. So I liken it to ballast. Like it's like a weight, like emotional mass. We build it up and it gives us our weight. It gives us our it's like a sense of momentum. So every day you get up and it like calibrates you to launch yourself into the day with a certain momentum and a certain reaction to resistance, and you're easily or less easily deflected based on all that stuff. So it's a networked consciousness, the basis of a networked consciousness that organizes animal behavior as if they are aware of the other's point of view and as if they are aware of consequences over time. And it sure does look like that, but if we pay really close attention, we'll start to notice a lot of anomalies and inconsistencies with the theories that are predicated on causes and effects, such as Skinner and conditioning and classical conditioning like Pavlov. There's actually inconsistencies with it, and you you might not notice them unless you really ask the right questions. And so I think that's been my calling, is being born into the world of dogs and animals. We had a lot of animals on the farm. It was a quasi-farm. And also being not quite domesticated. I didn't quite fit into the world of humans. So I kind of was an observer of humanity. And I never lost track with the animal consciousness that every young child begins life with. I just never lost it. And I was able to see things that didn't make sense that other people took for granted. And I think that allowed me to ask questions that no one else was asking, and therefore arrive at answers to those questions that no one else was asking. So it brings us full circle. So when you try to explain this to people, they will be triggered. Their emotional battery will be triggered. And I'm really happy to network with people like yourself so that together we can find ways to help people see what we're saying despite those triggers. That's my mission.
I guess as they get triggered, to resolve that energy for them and in a way that feels good to them.
Right, right. So we're all connected with the same. So what's interesting about unresolved emotion is it's the same in everyone. It's absolutely the same in everyone. We all feel it exactly the same way, which is why it can be the basis for a universal form of communication, because we all respond to it the same way. Like, actually, I'll go so far as to say that unresolved emotion as our ballast is the basis of every feeling, a true feeling. So when you study behavior as a function of attraction, which means you're studying emotion as a function of energy, those are really saying the same thing, then you can get underneath your thoughts and you can start to see what all things have in common. And that common, that's, I like to use example of a circle. Every point on the circle, every point on the circumference of the circle has the same common fundamental denominator, which is the center of the circle. And that center makes every point unique. So every point on the circumference has its own unique longitude and latitude, if we were to grid out the circle, an XY axis. They all have a unique place. And yet their uniqueness is a function of what they all have in common. So every animal acquires unresolved emotion to some degree, just like we all have physical mass. So I like to use example, when you see two dogs get together, it's exactly the same as two kids coming upon a seesaw on a playground. And one kid could be really heavy and one could be real thin, and yet they can easily learn by feel how to self-regulate so that they both get the same feeling of suspension by going up and down on that seesaw. That's actually what dogs are doing when they meet. They're learning how to go out to the end of the balance beam or shorten up their seat on the beam to make themselves equal. And that's what's going on when you see dogs interact. And there's a protocol to it, and that's what I'm trying to explicate with writing and more videos we get online.
So on a practical level, is there something that you can suggest for someone to start to get a sense as they're watching their dog interact with the world, maybe watching themselves interact with the world as well? How do they start to tap into that networked awareness and to see your picture?
Right. Well, the first thing is to understand that our intellect reflexively reads intention into everything. We even read intention into the weather. So we say things like, this rain, if you've had the kind of rain we've had, is unbelievable. And yet, I mean, we're all, you know, we like to read history, and we know that there's been really intense floods, much more severe than ours. So it's kind of odd that we would even say unbelievable. So what we're really doing is reading a a person. There's an intention to the weather. It's acting. We're really beseeching the weather person to stop acting irrationally. We want it to act more reasonably. So we say it's unbelievable. Like, this is just unacceptable. You're acting irrationally. Forget it. So the first thing you can do to access the network purely is to look at animals, and everything they're doing is a function of attraction. When the lion looks at the gazelle, it's attracted to the gazelle. When the gazelle looks at the lion, it's attracted to the lion. So I like to give the example of the deer. Why does the deer raise its tail when it sees the wolf or the dog or the human even? And, you know, the common response from behaviorism is it's warning. It serves as a warning to the other deer. But I've hunted deer, and if they didn't raise that white tail, I never would have seen the deer. I never would have. I don't hunt anymore, but I never would have had a successful kill, a hunt, if it wasn't for that white tail. And so the real purpose of the tail is it's a state of attraction, arousal toward the predator. And I was working with a trapper once, and he was telling me that the tail has a mesmerizing effect on the predator so that it doesn't judge, it can't effectively judge the speed and distance of the deer. And wow, that hit a chord with me, because I once tried to shoot a deer by looking at the tail, and you can't do it. It throws you completely off track. You have to tune that out. Experienced hunters tune that out. So the deer is actually attracted to the wolf, and if the wolf will get mesmerized by that tail, and as soon as that deer goes out of sight, it tucks its tail and sneaks 180 degrees out of sight, the other direction, but the wolf keeps on going. He was invested with 200,000 volts of momentum by that big white tail, and even when he can't see the tail, the memory of it keeps pulling him along until he exhausts that momentum, and then the deer is long gone. So everything about nature functions as attraction. I invite people, like to ask people to go to the Museum of Natural History and go to the dioramas and look at all the animals and all the scenes that are brought back to life. And you'll notice that every animal is attracted, no matter the species, no matter what it's doing. You know, it's poised in that attracted state. So that's step one. When you see your dog looking at you, to realize he's attracted to you. Even if a dog was going to bite you, he's still attracted to you. He has no intention of hurting you or pleasing you or anything like that. That's all a concoction of the human intellect. So tuning that out, getting underneath that, reveals something that's far more magical and powerful. So that's
when you say attraction, do you mean that it's a 'cause you know, some people might read intention into the word attraction.
Oh yeah, no, so, I don't mean intention. Everything but intention.
So but attraction is a way for an animal to release that stress.
Right. It feels a pull toward what it's attracted to. So I like, that's a good point. You can, whatever you can say about gravity, you can say of emotion and vice versa. So whenever there's a change in the animal's perceptual field, it's his body mind has been displaced. In order to come back to neutral, it must make contact with what it's attracted to. It feels an attraction to that source of change, and then it feels compelled to connect with it in order to bring its internal mechanisms back to stasis. So
I got to think that some people listening to this are going to say, well, why doesn't, if the deer is attracted to the wolf or the hunter or whatever, why doesn't the deer run toward the
actually,
wolf?
Yes, and then you have to look at a phenomena that I call emotional capacity. There's only so much emotion that any given individual or species has evolved to carry. So it's sort of like you have if you have an electrical wire and you plug in something, let's say you have an extension cord, and you plug an appliance into it that draws too much power. Well, it's going to exceed the carrying capacity of that electrical cord, and it'll start to heat up. So the deer feels this amazing attraction toward the wolf, but then it's going to pop, and it runs in fear from that place where it felt the collapse of its attraction. So you can get very, very precise. Once you understand everything is a function of attraction, you can get very precise about what's going on inside the deer or the wolf or the dog or any animal. You can start to see exactly how it arrived at a particular response. There's an amazing event that my mother-in-law told me. She lives in Ridgefield, Connecticut, a tremendous deer population, and they've been very acclimated to the presence of people and dogs even. And she told me that there was this troop of deer going by her house, and her house is fenced off with a clear wire fence, and she has a German Shepherd that came out of herding bloodlines, which is significant to this story. And as the deer were going by, this was a herding bloodlines from Germany. The dog didn't bark. It started pacing. So, and that's a very effective herding behavior for a German sheep herder, because it'll pace along a line rather than chasing the sheep. It resolves the stress by pacing along parallel to the sheep, and that keeps the sheep behind its movements, keeps the sheep contained. At any rate, the last deer in the line was a very young one, and my mother-in-law couldn't believe it. The young one saw this dog pacing back and forth and came all the way over to the fence and then did a play bow and tried to play with it through the fence. So, of course, it could only go so far, and eventually it, you know, that collapsed and it went off and rejoined the rest of the deer. So I have an expression that when deer feel really safe, they behave like dogs, and conversely, when dogs feel really afraid, they behave like deer. So there's this universal operating system to absolutely all animal consciousness, and it's actually easy to show it in like chickens and ravens and the deer and the dogs and the horses. There's one universal operating system, emotion as a force of attraction, but then they vary according to carrying capacity. When the carrying capacity is breached, then animals respond via their species niche, their pre-programmed genes. That's when genes take over. So theoretically, any two animals can communicate with each other on the pure emotional plane, and on very rare circumstances we see it. And it's so easy to find on the internet now. There's the gazelle adopted by the lioness that was documented on NPR. There's the tortoise and the hippo that bonded after the 2004 tsunami. You know, there's swimmers saved by dolphins. There's there's just all these examples of interspecies communication. My premise is that this is when, for whatever reasons, the animals involved could get down to the pure level of energy and communicate based on feeling. Do you feel what I feel? Which is incidentally why we, when we meet people, always talk about the weather. We're getting down to pure energy. We're saying, do you feel what I feel? Oh, it's hot today. Yep, I'm hot. Oh, it's cold today. Yep, I'm cold. It's rainy. Yep, it's rainy. We're resonating on that energy level. Of course, we're doing it with a very high abstract concept and symbols and language and all this and that, but you boil it down, it's no reason why we should reflexively, innately, intuitively, irresistibly talk about the weather when we first meet people. But it's linking up according to the emotional, on the emotional plane. So the highest emotional capacity of any animals on earth are dogs and human beings. And this is how we communicate, we interact on that deep, deep level. And if we could understand that, we could learn a lot about how emotion works within us. And that's what dogs are really here and to show us. And we're so focused on dogs spiritually and dogs being abused and dogs, we're saving dogs and all that narrative. And the real story is that dogs are here to save us, to help
us.
Well,
that seems like a perfect segue into talking a little bit about your new book that's coming out, which is called Your Dog is Your Mirror, right?
Right. Yep.
And this book is, it's, I guess, currently available for pre-order on Amazon. It's not actually coming out until sometime in the fall, right? October, is that?
Right, October this fall, yep.
It's being released by New World Library, which is
yep.
very exciting, great publisher.
Nice.
This conversation has been fascinating, and you know, I feel like it's, you know, the summer of 2004 all over again.
Yeah, all right.
But
yeah.
but can you and I know we've actually been probably talking about a lot of what's in your book, but you know, a lot of people they get interested in you and your work and what you do, and they read they buy Natural Dog Training, the first book that you wrote. And so I'm wondering if you can encapsulate a little bit, how is this book going to be different? And, you know, where I'm assuming you pick up sort of where you left off, and, you know, obviously a number of years have gone by as well. So.
Yeah, well, I feel like this book is the logical extension of that book. And a lot, the core ideas are in that book. It's said maybe a little more obtusely than it could have been said. It should have been said. So it's kind of hard to get some of it, but it really amazes me. It's all there. But I started to realize that just, you know, I was studying dogs as a function, two dogs as a function, one mind. And then I finally realized, wow, same thing is true of the owner in the dog. The dog is tuning in to what the owner's feeling and then responding appropriately. And he's either doing what the owner needs him to do or he's doing what the owner wants him to do, and the latter being a desirable, the first being what we call problem behavior. So the first breakthrough happened. I was working with a woman, and she had this dog going through this amazing separation, what people call separation anxiety. It was tearing the house apart. She'd been evicted from two apartments. She was about to be evicted from another apartment. She would go to Walmart to shop, and her license plate is broadcast over the PA system. Whoever owns this Toyota pickup truck, please come to the desk. She'd get to the desk. She'd say, no, that's okay. It's my dog. I mean, the dog is rocking the truck while she's in the store. She said, no, don't worry, he's fine. And the people said, no, lady, you get that dog, or we're calling the cops. This is the truck was literally levitating with this hysteria this dog could put out. So anyhow, she came to me for training, and I was going to teach the dog how to get in the crate and how to learn to be alone by itself and so on. And we went through that whole process. But in the course of talking to her, I said, you know, it isn't really separation anxiety. It's actually a panic attack. I don't look at it as separation anxiety. I use the word panic and attack as separate words cobbled together. I mean, it's a form of attacking something. But at any rate, she said, wow, 10 years ago I had a panic attack, and she was actually arrested for threatening people with her son's crossbow. And they actually threw a net over her, and they carted her off to an institution, and she was institutionalized for 5 or 6 years, and she got out. She said, the first thing I'm going to do is get a dog so I can reconnect with a living sentient being. And that was the dog that we're now confronting with. So I realized, wow. I mean, she was totally functional, viable person, a great woman, but there was something unresolved in her, and this dog was picking it up and was expressing it now with its so-called separation anxiety. So I just made a real big breakthrough with that dog, and I then asked, well, if that's true, what about my dogs? And then all of this, within about 20 seconds, a flood of realizations hit me. Oh, my God, all my dogs are just like me. And, I mean, I raised some dogs as a puppy. I adopted dogs. I got a dog sight unseen from Germany once. Had nothing to do with its upbringing. And yet they were all the same. And so it was quite the eye-opener. And then I realized that, wow, this whole training thing is really kind of irrelevant, that there's really – it's really this exchange of unresolved emotion going on between us. It's our batteries are interfacing, and the dog is being shaped by what we don't, what we're not even aware of, what's in our battery that we're not even aware of, because we're not designed to be aware of it. That's what the dog is really responding to. And you know, the other part to that whole process was, people would come in, they'd be distraught, their dog had to be put down if they didn't fix the problem, and I'd fix the problem, but they would go right back into the old patterns, and I actually couldn't get them. It was amazing. I couldn't get them, especially like the more intelligent they were, the harder it was to get them out of that loop, until I realized, wow, that dog is serving a purpose for them, a very deep, deep, deep purpose. Even though they're mortified that they might have to put the dog down, they'd rather put it down than give up that gratification, the visceral gratification that the dog is giving them by doing that kind of behavior, be it aggressive or anxious or whatever it happened to be. So those two linkages really is the basis of the dog. One's dog is one's mirror.
Wow. And so is your book going to, is it a manual for people? How does it?
Well, no, it's gonna start with a review of what we say we know about dogs and why none of that makes sense. Because I remember I mentioned earlier that our theories on dogs aren't actually based on the evidence. They're based on what animals make us feel, how they trigger our battery, and then we come up with theories. Like if you're a very controlling person, you're going to want to see control works in nature. So you're going to see a wolf pack and say, yeah, that's right. There's the dominant one. He controls the other ones. And then you may be in rebellion to the old dominant model, and you will see the wolves and say, no, they're being nice to each other. That's what makes it work. And the dogs aren't even connected to the wolf, as a matter of fact. They are scavengers. They came from dumps, and they're like little neotenized infantile proto-wolves. They're not, it makes no more sense to treat them like wolves than it would be to treat a human baby like chimps, just because we're primate first cousins. So it's these various theories that are out there have actually nothing to do with the evidence. Even Skinner saw the animals he probed and tested and observed as self-contained agencies of intelligence rather than as part of, as cogs in a networked intelligence. So he couldn't get past that mirror. And so the book goes through another way of looking at dogs, and then I start telling stories and some of the amazing things that dogs do that don't fit into the mainstream model. You know, the mainstream models have to dismiss a lot of stuff that animals do, earthquake detection, epileptic seizure detection, cancer detection. Unless they can fit it into a sense of smell, they dismiss a lot. So then I look at the common things that dogs do and see how even these things, sitting for a cookie, going for car rides, these things don't even fit into any model of behavior. So I do that for a couple chapters, then I get into the nature of emotion and seeing, you know, how I came to see dogs as creatures of the immediate moment, organized as a network. And then I go into specific case studies with people and their dogs, and a lot of stories, probably mostly stories, and then my own particular story, how my dogs reflected me and what that led me to understand. So I guess it's basically reinterpreting the paradigm in terms of dogs evolving by feel, to feel what we feel, and this is how they adapt to us. They feel what we feel, and this is how they know how to get along in our world. They're the only animal that can fully do that, and therefore they're the only animal that's completely in our life. We can even work with a dog. And so it's taking all the evidence on dogs, the extraordinary and the ordinary, and showing how it adds up to a new understanding that your dog is your emotional reflection. And by seeing that, it's a wonderful healing opportunity. Instead of blaming the dog, you could say, whoa, I know what that comes from. Okay, that helps. That's good information. And what one does with that information is, you know, now they're in a position to choose. And I don't know what you should do with, you know, your various understandings. Everyone has their own way of doing things, and that's great. This is just the how to get that information up to the surface, and then you're in a position to deal with it.
I can imagine the reader, you know, tearing their way through the book. You know, it's fascinating. The stories are so gripping, and it transforms their mind. And then they close the book, and the first thing they do is look over at their dog, and just that like pregnant pause of.
Right. And he's looking right in at them as well. Yeah. So if you could see that your dog's consciousness, this is a hard thing to get, that his consciousness is not between his ears, behind his eyes. It's in the flow of energy between him and you. And that interplay is his consciousness. It's a really, we want to contain consciousness. Our intellect wants to isolate it and fixate it and put it in a box and say, that's where it is. And it's a function of these material processes, you know, neurons and genes. Okay, we can deal with that. It's a very mechanical view. But what I've, it's a hard thing to get your mind around on one level, but what I've realized is that consciousness is the movement of energy reflecting back on itself and back on itself and elaborating and evolving into more and more complex, intricate expressions. That's actually what it is. And what I'm trying to do is make that concrete so that it's realizable. It took me a long, long time to become comfortable with it and make it the most real thing that I see now. When I see three or four dogs, I see one mind overarching those dogs. I no longer see three or four dogs interacting as separate entities. I see one being, one organism, working according to one system, and it's very liberating.
And do you find that you are? Do you see humans the same way now as well?
It's completely a choice on our part. We have to choose it. So no, a human is a self-contained. On one level, I should say we can be self-contained. Ultimately, of course, we can't. No man is an island. I think I have a chapter called, I don't know if it's going to get renamed. I've written this thing over so many years that I can't remember what chapters are actually in the table of contents, but there's a heading somewhere called No Animal is an Island. And that, of course, is true of humans. But we do have self-contained brains. We can think in complete contravention to anything else on one level. Ultimately, we can't, but we have our own individual destinies, whereas the dog participates in a collective consciousness completely. Like, for example, I don't think a dog has an individual soul. I think it participates in a canine soul. So when it dies, it reintegrates. If you get into metaphysics and philosophy and religion, you could probably make a very good case for the individual human soul. So when I see a dog and a human, I know that the dog is part of that human system. And so it's sort of like you could use your dog, you know, could you imagine if you could see a videotape of yourself going through things? You ever see those times when those shows, 2020 or something, Diane Sawyer will be interviewing a couple and they're not very good parents and they're always scolding the kids and smacking them in the behind, and then later they have the parents sitting down with the child expert and they're looking at how they parent the child and the parents are just aghast at them. They feel so bad, and Diane Sawyer is so warm and it makes them feel comfortable and they heal, and they just saw themselves there, and they say, forget it, I'll never do that again. I get that my kid isn't like that. Well, I thought it was. Something else was going on. So if you could see your dog as your reflection, it takes all the weight off the dog, and it really opens up the connection. And it's given me a lot of humility, and I was raised in a pretty critical way, so I always had to be guarded, and you can get pretty brittle. So seeing your dog as a reflection makes you very humble, and it's softening.
The woman whose dog was having the panic attacks, as you put it, did she have to do something specific about...
You know, she was... I didn't quite get it then. With that woman, it just struck me. I wish I could say that I started talking to her about that, but I didn't. She was... I went through the mechanics of dog training, and I wasn't looking at it with that dog yet, saying how, wow, I mean, I know you think you've healed, but maybe you haven't. Maybe you're just medicating yourself, and maybe you're not really dealing with it. Now I would, if she was interested, I would go further with it. But it just struck me when she said, wow, I had a panic attack. I'll just never forget. That struck me. And that caused me, over the course of working with her, at some point I started saying, what about my dogs? So it's funny how these things slowly, they seem so obvious to me now, but it really was a slow process of dawning. And it really meant reversing a lot of my own philosophy, because I wanted to be the trainer. I wanted to solve the problem. I wanted to rescue the day and be the hero. But I started realizing, wow, that's not what's really happening here. And there's no humility in that. So I have to become some kind of agent for change and work, figure out the right words to say and know when to speak up and when not to say anything and trust in their judgment and that kind of thing. So it was a gradual process, but that was the first, I can remember that dog was the first dog that really opened my eyes. It was just so vivid what was going on.
Well, it seems to me so appropriate that your book is coming out with New World Library, considering some of the other authors in their roster, people like Eckhart Tolle and I saw Deepak Chopra. I don't know if they do all his books or just some of his books. But when you said that, and I know this from having worked with you before, but that dogs really make it concrete, that you start to see things like consciousness on itself or a networked consciousness or, all the things that you've been talking about, unresolved stress mobilizing as emotional energy. It's a similar kind of thing to what they're talking about, but I think often the struggle with people in comprehending that is like, make it real for me, make it concrete.
Right.
And,
right.
We've talked before about how, that's why working with your dog can be so amazingly powerful on that level.
Right.
Because it makes those metaphysical concepts concrete for people.
It brings it down to planet Earth, exactly. Yep.
I can just see the behaviorists getting, recoiling from the conversation at this point. But
yeah, well, it turns out, I enjoy going intellectual toe-to-toe, and at some point that may prove fruitful, but that their theories end up being more magical thinking than this one. This actually is the most down-to-earth theory in my mind that there can be. Emotion is the basis, it's the most down-to-earth form of communication as possible. And all the sciences are trending in this direction. There's a great book called The First Idea, and it talks about emotion being the basis of language and concept formation, and the whole system of emergent science. That word wasn't even around in the 70s and 80s when I started understanding dogs as a self-organizing system of intelligence. So epigenetics is another really amazing study where stress and pleasure changes the expression of genes. Dr. Bruce Lipton is a great expositor on this, a wonderful researcher, and the very, you know, having a stress response actually changes the way your genes express themselves. So the fact that there's a direct language between emotion and stress, that it's a one-to-one inverse relationship, and that that would affect how genes are expressed, I think is a wonderful mechanism for a network consciousness, that ultimately the genes themselves could shift, not based on random mutations, but in accordance with the way emotion and stress is being regulated and moderated through the network. Every animal interaction has a registry in the cells of that animal and affects its emotional and stress responses, and that affects how their genes express. So I think we're on a whole new paradigm with how evolution actually happens and the real role that emotion plays in it. It's you know, this tremendous research being done on emotion now was backwaters for all these years, but now it's come to the fore. So I am very gratified that the more I read the Science Times, and it's my Bible, and every new advance, I just see more and more traction for what I've been trying to say. So, it's helpful too, because this new science gives us mechanisms to implement what we're talking about, and gives us an easier way to talk about it. You know, the idea of epigenetics gives us a really easy way to understand the interface between the environment and the individual. And I'm just saying, let's take it one step further. Let's say, if the environment directly affects the individual on a genetic level, well, what if they're all linked through a common operating system in the most primal way? That would mean that all the genes are linked through that same system. So the science, I'm really, really happy to see the science coming together, so that I predict that the behaviorism that we're talking about now is going to seem like Luddites in no time. We'll be on the cutting edge, I'm happy to say.
Well, the conversation is definitely growing and getting more and more interesting. As I mentioned at the beginning, on your website, naturaldogtraining.com, there have been some great discussions, some heated, but a lot of just great back and forth and feedback. And you have some, you know, articles with, you know, over 100 comments on them, and that's really been a chance for you, because you're very active in the comments and in evolving the conversation. Mm-hmm. People are have been on in the forum on Natural Dog Blog as well, talking about the work that they're doing with their dogs. So it's and of course Lee Kelly
right.
has been there out on Psychology Today on their website with his blog. So the ripples are working their way out, and it's going to be very exciting, particularly once your book comes out.
Right.
I think that's really going to add some great fuel to the fire.
I'll be reinterpreting Pavlov. I'm kind of holding that in reserve for the book. It's going to be, I'm going to take the what Pavlov actually discovered to make this, what I'm saying about this connection, this physical connection between the individual, the animal, and the environment. That's going to be a big revolutionary statement, I believe.
You know, it would be awesome is if you could do that, you know, actually kind of capture it on video and have a little... You know, when you first said what I'm going to be doing is you know, reinterpreting,
reinterpreting
Pavlov. I almost imagined you like going to some square in New York City and like setting up a podium and like, you know, here's
But maybe I'll do a little when the book comes out. Maybe I'll do a little before the book comes out. I'll do a little discussion on Pavlov. Maybe I could put that on my website.
Awesome.
The publisher doesn't object. I really want to talk about that. This book, I believe, is going to give people a language to really understand a network consciousness just through the simple way we talk about feelings that you just get. okay, that's why my dog does that. In other words, you know, you could say stuff like, well, my dog doesn't think he's going for a car ride. He feels he's already on the car ride. That's why he's so excited when he hears the jingle of the keys. So we just have to shift our perspective a little bit, and this amazing world right into nature opens up. I mean, the window just is flung quite a bit open, and you see a whole nother way of understanding why the dog's doing what it's doing. And I think it's going to be exhilarating. I think it's going to take a lot of weight off the dog-owner relationship, and it'll be much more fulfilling. That's
Plus, it's true for people, too. You know, they change their language for describing situations, change their metaphors,
right.
And it's like then the whole world really shifts.
That's right, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, one of the big breakthroughs I had in the training was when I realized that, you know, if my dog makes a mistake, it's because he's not attracted enough to me. That's the only thing that's wrong, is he's not enough attracted to me. Huh, now what do I do? He's not disobeying me, he's not this or that. And so I always teach people when the dog makes a mistake to always use the word confused. Because if he really felt enough attraction, he would never make a mistake. He would absolutely never make a mistake. It's not in his nature. But he just doesn't feel attracted in that moment. And you can then, once you use words like confused, it takes the weight off, and then you can start to understand what fusion means. Okay, well, let me get him fused then. And that changes the paradigm, and it takes the weight off, especially for the dog. Poor dogs. Oh, well.
Well, I have, you know, of course, a million more questions that I could ask you, and I'm sure that, you know, everything that you've said, I'm sure that everyone listening, it's going to just be, you know, there'll be light bulbs, there'll be question marks, and as we talked about earlier, I'm really hopeful that we'll be able to get you back, Kevin, for a conference call.
Oh, that'd
and,
be great.
Where you'll be able to talk live with people and get questions answered. And, you know, I'm sure it could be everything from, you know, explaining your metaphysics to, you know, how to build attraction in a dog.
Right. I would look forward to that.
So, you know, keep an ear out, everyone, for when that's happening. It won't be long. And then the other thing that I just wanted to mention, Kevin is going to be giving a seminar in Roe, Massachusetts at the Roe Center.
Yep.
It's called Journey to the Heart of the Dog. And Kevin, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the dates are May 14th through 16th.
Right. Yep. It's an immersion weekend. So we all live together and go through all the theories and the practical application. And it's a lot of fun.
So for those of you who can get to Massachusetts, I absolutely, I mean, I spent a month with a guy. I can definitely recommend you spend a weekend there absorbing this new, for some of you, others of you, it's just it'll be an enhancement of what you've already been coming to understand about how your dog works and how emotion works. So you can find out more information about that seminar on Kevin's website, naturaldogtraining.com.
Right.
So, Kevin, I really appreciate your taking the time to talk this evening.
Oh, yeah, no, it's my pleasure, Neil. Anytime.
And we will definitely be talking again soon, and thank you to all of you who have listened. And you all have a great, whatever it is, night, day, and we'll be back shortly.